watching as she took a sip. It's not bad. As good as your pies? No. I laughed, watching as she took another sip and surveyed the house. Despite myself, I was grateful for my mom's training. Natalie, no doubt, now thought of me as tidy, in addition to rather charming. Or maybe not. I knew I was interested in her, but she was still a mystery to me. You've made some changes to the place, she noted. Though I loved living in a time capsule, I felt the need to update the decor. It seems more open, too. My grandfather had a lot of stuff. I got rid of it. My parents are like that. On the fireplace mantel back home, there must be 50 framed photographs. Try to dust one, and they topple like dominoes. I don't understand it. Maybe the older people get, the more important the past becomes, because there's less future ahead. Maybe, she said, without adding anything else. Unable to read her, I pushed open the back door. Ready? I followed her out onto the back porch, watching her settle in the same rocker as she had the first night I'd met her. Unlike me, she didn't lean back. Instead, she remained propped on the edge, as if ready to jump up and run away if she had to. After all our banter, I was surprised that she wasn't more relaxed, but I was getting the feeling that Natalie was full of surprises. I took a sip of my tea, watching as she gazed toward the creek, her profile as perfect as cut glass. I think I could stare at this forever. Me too, I said, looking only at her. She smirked, but decided to let my remark pass. Do you ever swim out there? I did when I was a kid. Right now, the water's still too cold. That might be a good thing. Apparently, someone sighted some alligators a little ways upstream. Seriously? It's pretty rare to find them this far north. We get reports of them once or twice a year, but I've never had any luck sighting any. They tend to be in places cars can't reach. If you'd ever like to go out on the water, I've got the boat right out there. That might be fun, she agreed before folding her hands in her lap, suddenly all business again. What did you want to tell me about the bees? Let's start with this, I said, setting my glass aside. How much do you know about bees, and how much do you want to know? I have about an hour, maybe a little more, so tell me whatever you think will be important. Fair enough, I said. Bee colonies have an annual cycle. In the winter, a hive might have 5 or 10,000 bees. In the spring, once it warms up, the queen begins laying more eggs and the population begins to grow. During the summer months, a hive might hold up to 100,000 bees, which is why an apiarist might add another chamber to the hive. Then, as autumn approaches, the queen begins to lay fewer eggs. The population starts to diminish again, because the colony somehow knows it hasn't stored enough honey to feed all the bees. In the winter, the remaining bees eat the honey to survive. They also cluster together and vibrate to create heat so the colony doesn't freeze. When it begins to warm, the cycle starts all over again. She digested that, then held up a hand. Hold on, she said. Before you go on, I want to know how you learned all this stuff. Did your grandfather teach you? We tended the hives together whenever I was down here visiting, but I also heard him give the talk to lots of different people. When I was in high school, I even did a semester-long project on bees for my science class. Just making sure you know what you're talking about. Go on. Did I detect a bit of flirting in her tone? I reached for my tea again, trying not to lose track of my thoughts. Her beauty was distracting. Every hive also has a single queen. Assuming the queen doesn't get sick, she lives from 3 to 5 years. Early on in her life cycle, the queen flies around and gets fertilized by as many male bees as she can before returning to the hive, where she'll lay eggs for the rest of her life. The eggs turn to larvae, and then pupae, and when they're mature, the bees are ready to serve the hive. Unlike the queen, these worker bees live only 6 or 7 weeks, and they'll cycle through a variety of different jobs in their short lives. The vast majority are female. The males are called drones. And all the drones do is mate with the queen and eat. You remembered. It was hard to forget, she said. What happens if the queen dies? Bee colonies have a fail-safe, I answered. No matter what time of year, when a queen is weakening or not laying enough eggs, the nurse bees will start feeding several of the larvae a substance called royal jelly. This food changes the larvae into queens, and the strongest one will take over. If necessary, that new queen will then replace the older queen, at which point she'll fly away and mate with as many drones as she can before returning to the hive to spend the rest of her life laying eggs. That isn't much of a life for a queen. Without her, the colony will die. That's why she's called the queen. Still, you'd think she'd get to go shopping or attend a wedding every now and then. I smiled, recognizing in her humor something akin to my own. Now, yesterday I mentioned a few of the jobs bees do during their life cycle, clean the hive or feed the larvae or whatever. But the majority of bees in any hive collect pollen and nectar. A lot of people might think that pollen and nectar are the same, but they're not. Nectar is the sugary juice in the heart of the flowers. Pollen, on the other hand, are tiny grains that collect on the anthers. Want to guess which one leads to the making of honey? She pursed her lips. Nectar? Exactly, I said. A bee will fill its nectar sacs, fly back to the hive, and turn the nectar into honey. A bee also has glands that turn some of the sugar in the honey into beeswax. And little by little, honey is created and stored. How is nectar turned into honey? It's kind of gross. Just tell me. When a bee gets back to the hive with its load of nectar, it passes the nectar mouth to mouth to a different bee, who then does the same to another bee, over and over, gradually lowering the moisture content. When it gets concentrated enough, it's called honey. She made a face. For a second, I could picture her as a teenager. That is kind of gross. You asked. What happens with bees who bring in pollen? Pollen is mixed with nectar to make bee bread. That's what they feed the larvae. And the royal jelly? I don't know how that's made, I admitted. I used to know, but I've forgotten. Well, at least you're honest. Always, I said. But that brings us to another important point. Because the bees need to eat the honey to survive the winter, an apiarist has to be careful not to take too much when they harvest. How much is that? My grandfather would only harvest about 60% of the honey in any given hive, some in June and the remainder in August. Some of the larger producers will take a higher percentage, but it's generally not a good idea. Is that what happened to the bees? What do you mean? I read some articles saying that bees were dying out, and that if they did, humanity wouldn't survive. The latter part is true. Without bees spreading pollen from one plant to another, many crops simply can't survive. As to the first part, the decline in the bee population probably has less to do with over-harvesting than the overuse of chemicals to clear the hive. My grandfather never used chemicals because, really, you don't need them. I'll show you when we get out there, but I think that's it for now. I set my glass aside. Unless there's something else you'd like to know. Yeah, about the guard bees. Why do they buzz around your face? Because it works, I said with a laugh. People don't like it, so they retreat. Keep in mind that in the wild, bears will ravage beehives. The only way a tiny bee can protect the hive from a giant bear is to sting it in the eyes, the nose, or the mouth. She hesitated. Okay, but I still don't like them. That's why we'll be wearing suits. You ready? Natalie stood from her seat and led the way inside before stopping in the kitchen to deposit her glass. Meanwhile, I pulled two spoons from the kitchen drawer, wrapped them in a paper towel, and put them in my pocket. Retracing our steps to the front porch, I handed the smaller suit to her. Slip this on over your clothes, I said. I pulled off my shoes, then put on a suit. Natalie did the same, and I made sure everything was zipped properly. After we put our shoes back on, I handed her the mesh hood. It was connected to a hat with a round brim, and the gloves, then used the lighter to get the smoker going. What's that? It's a smoker. It calms the bees. How? The bees interpret smoke as part of a forest fire, and they'll begin feeding on the honey in case they have to move the hive somewhere else. I collected the rest of the gear and motioned for her to follow. We set off in the direction of the hives, passing clutches of azalea bushes, into an area dense with dogwoods, flowering cherry trees, and magnolias. The air was thick with the sound of buzzing, and bees could be seen clustering on practically every bloom. At the edge of the property, the vegetation grew denser. Directly ahead, I caught sight of one of the hives. Though my grandfather had built his own, they were similar to ones that could be purchased as kits or used by commercial farmers, consisting essentially of a stand supporting a stack of wooden chambers along with lids. As always, I was amazed by the idea that it would be home to more than 100,000 bees. We should stop here and put on the rest of our gear. After donning our gloves, we approached the hive, bees bumping against the mesh of our hoods. I added air to the smoker and puffed out some smoke near the hive before setting it on the ground.
"That's it?"
"You don't need much smoke," I explained. "Bees have an acute sense of smell." I pointed toward an area beneath the lip of the lid. "Do you see this? It's how the bees get in and out of the hive." She took a cautious step closer.
"How long do we have to wait for the smoke to work?"
"It's working now," I said. "They'll be calm for 15 or 20 minutes."
"Does the smoke hurt them?"
"Not at all," I said. "Let me show you the inside of the hive." Lifting off the top lid, or outer cover in beekeeper speak, I set it aside. Then, using the uncapping knife, I loosened the inner cover. Always a bit sticky, it was harder than usual to pry off, probably because it hadn't been removed in months. Once I freed the inner cover, I set it on the ground as well. "Come take a peek," I said. "They're friendly now." With obvious trepidation, she peered over my shoulder. I pointed to the top chamber. "This part of the hive is called the upper deep. It's the food chamber. There are 10 hanging frames, and this is where most of the honey is stored." Pointing to the chamber beneath it, I went on. "The one right below is called the lower deep, and it's the brood chamber."
"Wow," she murmured.
There were hundreds of slow-moving bees crawling on top of and between the frames. Natalie seemed genuinely rapt. "I'm glad you were interested in coming here," I said. "Otherwise, I probably would have forgotten to add the shallow super and the queen excluder. I didn't remember until I saw them in the honey shed."
"What are they for?"
"The shallow super adds additional honey storage to the hive for the larger summer bee population. It's like the upper deep, only smaller. The queen excluder ensures that the queen won't up and fly away."
"You don't need them year-round?"
I shook my head. "You'll want a smaller hive in the winter so it's easier to keep warm." On the upper deep, bees continued to crawl around with unflagging energy and purpose. I pointed to a large wasp-like one. "See this one?" I asked. "That's a drone." She peered closer, then eventually pointed to another.
"That one too?"
I nodded. "As I told you, they're greatly outnumbered by the females, like Hugh Hefner in the Playboy Mansion."
"Nice metaphor," she drawled.
I grinned. "Let me show you something." I removed my gloves, then reached down and gently picked up one of the worker bees by her wings. She was still docile from the smoke. Using the thumbnail on my other hand, I provoked her until she tried to sting me through the nail.
"What are you doing?" Natalie whispered. "Are you trying to make her angry?"
"Bees don't get angry." I manipulated the bee again, and again it tried to sting me 3, 4, and then 5 times. "Watch this," I went on. I put the bee on the back of my hand and let go of the wings. Instead of continuing to try to sting, the bee took a few steps and then flew slowly back toward the upper deep. "The bee doesn't care about me or what I just did to her," I said. "She was just trying to protect herself. Now that the threat is gone, she doesn't hold a grudge." Through the mesh, I read fascination and newfound respect.
"Interesting," she said. "Way more complex than I imagined."
"Bees are extraordinary creatures," I said, hearing the echo of my grandfather's voice. "Do you want to see the honey? And the larvae?"
"I'd love to," she said.
Using the uncapping knife, I loosened one of the frames at the top edge, then loosened the other side until I could slowly pull it free. As I did, I watched Natalie's eyes widen. The frame was covered with hundreds of bees on both sides.
After checking it over and determining that the cells didn't have the variety I wanted, I slid it back into the hive. "There should be a better one," I remarked. "It's still early in the season." It took 3 frames before I found the one I wanted, and I removed it fully from the hive. Like the others, it was swarmed with bees, and I held it in front of her. "Do you remember when I told you that big producers use chemicals to clear the hives so they can harvest the honey?" "I remember." "This is why you don't need chemicals." I took a small step back and with a quick motion jerked the frame up and down. Nearly all the bees flew away, and I held up the virtually empty frame in front of her. "That's all you have to do to clear the bees from the frame so you can get to the honey," I said. "Just a single quick shake."
"Then why do the big producers use chemicals?"
"I have no idea," I said. "I haven't been able to figure that out yet." Angling the frame for a better view, I pointed to various cells as I spoke. "These cells up here in the corner, covered in the beeswax, are filled with honey. These lighter ones down here contain larvae and eggs. And the empty ones will all be filled with honey by the end of the summer." More comfortable with the hive now, Natalie moved even closer. There were still a few bees on the frame, and she slowly reached a finger of her gloved hand toward one of them, marveling as it ignored her completely. Another slowly crawled over her gloved finger, then onto the frame again.
"They're not mad that you shook off all their friends?"
"Not at all."
"What about killer bees?"
"They're different," I said. "As a colony, they're a lot more aggressive in protecting the hive. These bees might send out 10 or 15 guard bees when they feel the hive is threatened, but killer bees will send out hundreds of guard bees. There are some historical and evolutionary theories as to the reason why, but unless you're really interested, we can save that for another time. Do you want to taste some of the honey?"
"Now?"
"Why not? We're here."
"Is it ready?"
"It's perfect," I assured her. Reaching into my pocket, I pulled out the spoons and unwrapped them. I held one out to her. "Would you mind holding this for a second?" She took the spoon while I used the other to crush my way through some of the beeswax-coated cells. Raw, pure honey spilled onto the spoon. "Trade you," I said. Natalie took the spoon with honey, while I did the same to mine. "Hold this one for a second, too, okay?" She nodded. Her eyes flickered from me to the honey, golden in the sunlight. I reassembled the hive, picked up the smoker and uncapping knife, then took one of the spoons from her. We walked away from the hives in the direction of the shed. When we were a safe distance away, I motioned to her that it was fine to take off her hood and gloves. When I could see her face without the mesh, it was glowing with excitement and interest, her skin dewy with the light sheen of perspiration. I held up the spoon as though making a toast. "Ready?" I tapped my spoon against hers, then ate the honey, finding it was sweet enough to make my teeth hurt. After she tasted hers, she closed her eyes and took a long breath.
"It tastes
flowery
and delicious, but yes, there's a very strong floral flavor.
Honey will taste different depending on where the hive is located, because the nectar the bees collect will be different. That's why some honey is sweeter than others. Some have a slightly fruitier flavor, others more flowery. It's kind of like wine."
"I'm not sure I've noticed a big difference in flavors until now."
"Most commercial honey is clover honey. Bees love clover, which is why there's a clover patch on the property, too. But honey is also one of the most manipulated and lied about foods on the planet. A lot of commercial honey is actually honey mixed with flavored corn syrup. You have to be careful where you buy." She nodded, but there was something trance-like about her demeanor, as if the combination of the sun, the soothing droning of the bees, and the elixir of honey had relaxed the defenses she usually erected around herself. Her lips were parted and moist, her aquamarine eyes drowsy and translucent. When her gaze drifted from the hive to meet mine, I felt an almost hypnotic pull. I took a step toward her, the sound of my own breath loud in my ears. She seemed to know how I was feeling and was flattered by it. But just as quickly, she caught herself and picked up the hood and gloves, severing the thread of the moment. I forced myself to speak. "Would you like to see how the honey is extracted?
It'll only take a couple of minutes.
Sure.
Without another word, we started in the direction of the honey shed. When we got there, she handed me the hood and gloves, then proceeded to take off the bee suit. I did the same and put everything back in place. I moved the manual extractor away from the wall. She came over to inspect the extractor, but was careful to keep a safe distance. To harvest the honey, you take frames from the hive, shake off the bees, and load them in the wheelbarrow to bring them here, I began, slowly but surely regaining my equilibrium. Then, one at a time, you load the frames into the extractor, between these slots. You turn the crank, and it spins the frame. Centrifugal force will push the honey and beeswax from the combs. I turned the crank, demonstrating how it worked. Once the honey is spun out of the frame, you place one of those nylon bags into a plastic bucket, set it beneath the nozzle on the extractor, open the nozzle, and let the honey drain into the bucket. The nylon bag captures the wax but lets the honey pass through. After that, the honey goes into a jar, and it's ready to go. Wordlessly, Natalie took in the rest of the shed, wandering idly from one station to the next, finally stopping in front of the plastic garbage can. Lifting the lid, she saw the wood chips and shavings. By her expression, I knew she'd figured out that the contents were for use in the smoker. She examined the back wall, inspecting all the equipment, and waved at the rows of neatly labeled jars of honey. "It's so organized in here." "Always," I agreed. "My dad has a workshed like this," she commented, turning to face me again, "where everything has a purpose, everything has a place."
"Yeah?"
"He buys old transistor radios and phonographs from the 1920s and 1930s, and then repairs them in a shed behind our house. I used to love spending time there as a little girl when he was working. He had a high-backed stool, and he'd wear these glasses that magnified everything. I can still remember how big his eyes were. Even now, whenever I visit them in LaGrange, the shed is usually where the two of us talk about life."
"That's an unusual hobby."
"I think he finds it peaceful." She sounded wistful. "And he's proud of it, too. There's a whole section in the store with refurbished electronics on display."
"Does he sell any?"
"Hardly," she laughed. "Not everyone shares his fascination with antique electronics. Sometimes he talks about opening a small museum, maybe one that's attached to the store, but he's been talking about it for years, so who knows."
"What does your mom do while your dad is tinkering?"
"She bakes," she answered, "which is why I know how to make a great pie crust, and she sells what she bakes at the store, unless we eat it first."
"Your parents sound like good people."
"They are," she said. "They worry about me." I stayed quiet, expecting her to go on, but she didn't. I finally offered a gentle prod.
"Because you're a deputy?"
"Partly," she conceded. Then, as though realizing the conversation had veered in an unintended direction, she shrugged. "Parents always worry. That's the nature of parenthood. But that reminds me, I should get going. They'll be waiting for me."
"Of course," I said. "I'll walk you to your car."
We left the shed, walking down the pathway toward the drive. She drove an older model, silver Honda, a sensible car she probably intended to keep as long as it still ran. I opened the driver's side door for her. Inside, I saw her handbag on the passenger seat and a small crucifix hanging from the rearview mirror.
"I enjoyed the day so much," she said. "Thank you."
"I did too," I admitted.
"And you're welcome." The sun was at her back, making her face difficult to read. But when she placed her hand lightly on my forearm, I sensed that she, like me, didn't want the day to end just yet.
"How long will you be at your parents'?"
"Not long," she said. "I'll visit for a couple of hours and then head back home. I have to work tomorrow morning."
"How about we meet for dinner later, when you get back?"
She studied me carefully, then hedged. "I'm not sure what time that will be."
"Any time is fine," I said. "You could shoot me a text when you're leaving and I could meet you somewhere."
She trailed off before reaching into her pocket and pulling out her keys. "I don't like to go out in New Bern," she finally said. Though I could have asked her the reason, I didn't. Instead, I took a step backward, giving her space.
It's just dinner, not a commitment. Everyone's got to eat. She said nothing, but part of me began to suspect that she wanted to say yes. As to why she was holding back, I still wasn't sure.
I could meet you down at the beach if it's easier, I offered.
That's out of the way for you.
I haven't been to the beach since I've been back here, I said. I've been meaning to go.
Well, not really, not until just now, anyway. I don't know of any good restaurants at the beach, she said.
Then how about Beaufort? You must have some place you like there.
As I waited for her answer, she jingled her keys.
There is a place, she began, her voice barely audible.
Anywhere, I said.
The Blue Moon Bistro, she said in a rush, almost like she was afraid she would change her mind.
But it can't be too late.
Pick the time. I'll meet you there.
How about 6:30?
Perfect.
Thank you again for the beekeeping lesson today.
Glad to do it, I said.
I enjoyed spending time with you.
She let out a soft exhale as she slipped into the driver's seat.
Me too.
I closed her door and she turned the key. The engine came to life, and glancing over her shoulder, she backed the car out. As the car stopped and then began to roll forward, I reflected on the mystery of Natalie Masterson. By turns confident and vulnerable, revealing and secretive, she seemed to be a woman of complex instincts. Still, what had begun as a flirty diversion had already begun to morph into something deeper, a desire to connect with and truly understand a woman whom I couldn't figure out. Nor could I shake my desire to connect with the real Natalie, to leap the walls she seemed compelled to build between us, and perhaps form something even deeper and more meaningful. Even to me, it struck me as a romantic notion that bordered on the ridiculous. I reminded myself again that I didn't really know her, but at the same time, I know what my grandfather would have said. Trust your instincts, just like the bees do. Walking back to the house, I spotted the jars of honey on the porch table and realized she'd forgotten to take them. I put them in the SUV and spent the rest of the afternoon on the back porch with a textbook in my lap, trying not to think about Natalie or even my own feelings, but finding it impossible to concentrate. Instead, I replayed our time together over and over again, finally admitting to myself that I was simply counting the minutes until I could see her again.
Chapter 6. What to wear. Normally, I wouldn't have thought twice about it, but I found myself Googling the restaurant to get a better idea of the dress code. As far as I could tell, the place was tasteful and charming. Built in a historic home, the photos showed heart pine flooring, smaller tables with white tablecloths, and plenty of natural light streaming in through the windows. I could imagine getting away with jeans, but in the end, I went with your basic Annapolis look. Tan pants, a white button-up shirt, navy sport jacket, and topsiders. All I needed was a scarf, and I could walk around saying things like, "Anyone up for some yachting?" It would take a little under an hour to get there, but not wanting to be late, I made it across the bridge to Beaufort with at least 45 minutes to spare. The town was nestled on the intracoastal, and I parked near the waterfront, just around the corner from the restaurant. I spotted a pair of wild horses across the waterway, grazing on one of the many barrier islands that make up the coastline of North Carolina. My grandfather told me these horses were descended from the Mustangs that survived Spanish shipwrecks off the coast, but who knew if that was true? I decided to use the extra time to browse the art galleries along the waterfront. Most of the work was by local artists, featuring either beach themes or the historic architecture in Beaufort. In one of the galleries, I saw a painting of a house where Blackbeard the pirate had allegedly lived. I vaguely recalled that the wreck of Blackbeard's ship, the Queen Anne's Revenge, had been discovered in the Beaufort Inlet. The gallery owner confirmed my recollection, though he also admitted that there was some uncertainty about the whole thing. The wreck was estimated to be the correct size, and the cannons they'd found on the ocean floor were from that period, but there was nothing to specifically indicate the name of the ship. It wasn't as though they'd been able to reach into the glove compartment and check the registration, and the ocean can cause a lot of damage in 300 years. Wandering to the waterfront again, I noticed the sun slowly going down, casting a golden prism across the water. Heavenly light, my grandfather used to call it, and I smiled, reminiscing about all the times he'd brought me here for an afternoon at the beach, followed by an ice cream cone in Beaufort. Thinking back, I was amazed by how much time he'd been able to make for me whenever I was in town. I found myself turning again to his strange journey to Easley, my last visit with him, and his final mystifying words to me, "Go to hell." Not wanting to dwell on it, I shook the thought away. By then it was coming up on 6:30, and I started toward the restaurant, wondering whether she'd show. Just then, however, I saw Natalie's car pulling into an open space near my SUV. I turned in that direction, reaching her car just as she climbed out. She'd changed into a flowered, high-necked, sleeveless dress that accentuated her figure, and black medium-heeled boots with a sweater draped over her arm. A thin gold chain around her neck glowed in the waning light. When she reached inside the car for her purse, I noted how graceful her every move was. Her arms and legs were lithe and toned, swishing the thin fabric of her dress around in a tantalizing motion. Closing the car door, she turned and startled. "Oh, hey," she said. "I'm not late, am I?"
"You're actually a few minutes early," I said. "You look great."
She adjusted the thin necklace, as though making sure the locket, medallion, was hidden from view.
"Thank you," she said. "Did you just get here?"
"I came a little early," I said. "How did your visit with your parents go?"
"Same as usual," she sighed. "When he's at the beach, my dad likes to read on the back porch. My mom has been slowly decorating the place since they bought it, and was dying to show me the redecorated guest room. I love them to bits, but sometimes spending time with them feels like the movie Groundhog Day, where every day is the same."
I nodded in the direction of the restaurant.
"Do you want to head over?"
"Let me put my sweater on. It's a bit chilly, don't you think?" She held out her purse. "Can you hold this for a second?" As she slipped the sweater on, I found myself wondering if she felt self-conscious in her lovely, form-fitting dress. I wasn't cold in the slightest. Wrapping it tightly around her, she took her purse back and we crossed the street. There were few other people out and about. The town, I observed, was even sleepier than New Bern.
"When was the last time you ate at the Blue Moon Bistro?"
"It's been a while," she said. "A year and a half, maybe."
"Why so long?"
"Life, work, errands. Unless I'm visiting my parents, it's a little out of the way. As a general rule, I tend toward quieter evenings at home."
"Don't you and your friends ever go out?"
"Not too much, no."
"Why not?"
"Life, work, errands," she said again. "Because I'm still low on the totem pole at work. My schedule changes a lot. Sometimes I work days, other times it's nights and it changes regularly. It can be a challenge to schedule things with friends."
"That's inconvenient," I said.
"It is," she agreed. "But it pays the bills, and I'm very responsible."
"Always?"
"I try to be."
"That's too bad."
"No, it's not."
"I beg to differ," I said. "In the end, people generally regret the things they didn't do, not the things they did."
"Who told you that?" she scoffed.
"Common sense."
"Try again."
"My psychiatrist?"
"Did he really say that?"
"No, but I'm sure he would have. He's a very smart guy."
She laughed, and I noted how different she was from the first night I'd met her. It was almost as though her uniform had the ability to transform her personality. But then I realized that the same was true about me. In a lab coat or scrubs, I was one person. Dressed like a yachtsman, I was someone different. When we reached the restaurant, a teenage girl welcomed us. About half of the tables were occupied. She pulled a pair of menus from the stand and led the way to a small table near one of the many windows. As I walked, I heard the floor creaking with age and history. I pulled out Natalie's chair for her, then took a seat across from her. Through the window, the view didn't offer much, just another historic house directly across the street. No water view, no potential sunset. No wild horses. As though reading my mind, Natalie leaned across the table. "It's quaint, but the food is really good," she said. "Trust me."
Anything I should have in particular?
Everything is great, she assured me.
I nodded, and after spreading my napkin in my lap, I perused the menu.
I've decided to go on the seafood diet, I announced.
What's that?
Seafood and eat it.
She rolled her eyes, but I saw her crack a faint smile. In the silence, I studied the menu again before suddenly remembering what I'd left in the car.
By the way, you forgot to take the jars of honey I left for you.
I remembered as soon as I got home.
Well, anyway, I brought them for you, so remind me on our way out.
The waitress arrived and took our drink orders. Both of us ordered iced tea, along with water. When we were alone at the table again, I tried not to stare at her. The burnished halo of her hair in the candlelight framing her delicate features and unusually colored eyes. Instead, I delved into learning more about her, hungry for details about her past and everything that shaped the person she was now.
So your dad fixes old electronics, your mom bakes and decorates, I summarized.
How about your siblings? What can you tell me about them?
She shrugged. They're both in baby hell right now, she said. Or rather, toddler hell. Both have 2 kids under 3. Even compared to me, they have no life at all.
And you?
I've already told you about my life.
Some things, but not really.
Tell me what you were like as a kid.
It's not that exciting. I was pretty shy as a girl, although I loved to sing, she began.
But lots of young girls love to sing, and it's not as though I did anything with it. I guess I started coming into my own in high school and finally escaped my older siblings' shadows. I won the lead in the high school musical, joined the yearbook committee, even played soccer.
We have that in common, I said. Music and soccer.
I remember, she said, but I don't think I was as good as you were at either of them. I played soccer mainly so I could spend time with my friends. I didn't even start until I was a senior, and I think I only scored 1 goal the whole season.
I quickly chose the fried green tomatoes as an appetizer and tuna for the main course, setting the menu aside.
Did you go to high school in LaGrange?
LaGrange is too small for a high school, so I ended up going to Salem Academy. Have you heard of it?
When I shook my head, she went on.
It's an all-girls boarding school in Winston-Salem, she said. My mom went there, and so did my older sister, Kristen. My brother went to Woodbury Forest in Virginia. My parents were big on education, even if it meant shipping us off to boarding schools.
Did you like that?
Not at first. Even though my sister was there, I was homesick, and my grades were terrible. I think I cried myself to sleep every night for months, but I eventually got used to it. By the time I graduated, I loved it. And I still keep in touch with a few of the girls I met there. And I think going away to school helped when I went to NC State. When I moved into the dorms as a freshman, I was used to living without my parents, so the transition to college was super easy. But I'm still not sure I'd go that route with my own kids. If I ever have them, I mean. I think I'd miss them too much.
Do you want kids?
It took her a few beats to answer.
Maybe, she finally offered.
Not right now.
And for all I know, it might never happen.
The future remains unwritten, right?
I suppose.
She set her menu on top of mine at the edge of the table. I saw her eyes come to rest on my injured hand. Instead of hiding it, I spread my remaining fingers on the table.
Looks strange, doesn't it? I commented.
No, she shook her head. I'm sorry, it was rude of me to stare.
Misunderstandable. Even though I'm used to it, I still think it's strange. But losing fingers is better than losing an ear.
At her puzzled expression, I pointed to the side of my head.
This isn't real, I said. It's a prosthetic.
I wouldn't have known unless you'd told me.
I'm not sure why I did.
But I knew the reason. As much as I wanted to know her, I also wanted her to know the real me, to feel as though I could be completely open with her. She was silent for a moment, and I thought she'd change the subject, or even excuse herself to go to the restroom. Instead, she surprised me by reaching out and gently tracing the scarred stumps where my fingers used to be. The touch was electric.
The explosion must have been horrific, she said,
her fingertips still on my skin. "I've thought about it since you told me, but you didn't go into any detail. I'd like to hear about it, if you're comfortable telling me."
I offered a condensed version of the story, the random mortar blast after I'd exited the building, a flash of sudden heat and searing, and then nothing at all until I woke after my first surgeries, the flights to Germany and then back to the U.S., and the series of additional surgeries and rehabilitation at Walter Reed and Johns Hopkins. At some point, while I was speaking, she removed her hand from mine, but even after I finished, I could still feel the ghostly remnants of her touch.
"I'm sorry you had to endure all that," she said.
"If I could go back in time, I'd leave the hospital a few minutes earlier or later, but I can't. As for right now, I'm trying to move forward in positive ways."
"I'll bet your parents are still proud of you."
As soon as she said it, I remembered my previous experiences when I'd shared what had happened to them. I knew I should simply offer something ambiguous, like, "I hope so," without going into details, but with the way Natalie was looking at me, I realized I didn't want to keep the words inside me. "My parents died a month before I graduated from college. They were taking a trip to Martha's Vineyard, some political soiree that probably meant virtually nothing in the long run. A client had chartered a plane, but they never made it. The plane crashed in Virginia less than 5 minutes after takeoff."
"Oh my God, that's awful."
"It was," I said. "One day they were there, and the next day they were gone, and I was crushed. The whole thing felt surreal, still does sometimes. I was only 22, but I still felt like I was closer to being a teenager than an adult. I can still remember when my commanding officer came into my class and called me to his office so he could tell me. I hesitated, the memories still vivid. Because I was largely done with my classes, the academy gave me leave to handle the affairs, and that was in some ways even more surreal. My grandfather came up to help, but still, I had to find a funeral home and choose caskets and pick out a dress for my mom and suit for my dad. Figure out what they would have wanted for services. I'd just spoken on the phone to them a few days earlier.
"I'm glad your grandfather was there for you."
"We needed each other, no question about it. He'd already lost his wife and had just lost his only child. We ended up driving back to New Bern after the services, and I don't think either of us said a word the entire trip. It wasn't until we got to his house that we could even talk about it at all, and we both shed a lot of tears that week. It was just so sad for me to think of all the things they would never have the chance to do, or what my future would be like without them."
"I can't imagine losing my parents like that."
"There are moments when I still can't. It's been a decade now, but sometimes it still feels like I should be able to pick up the phone and call them."
"I don't know what to say."
"No one does. It's hard for people to fathom. I mean, who becomes an orphan at 22? It's not as though there are many people who ever have to deal with something like that." She looked away, as though still trying to process what I said, just as the waitress arrived to take our dinner orders. Almost robotically, Natalie ordered a beet salad and red snapper, and I ordered the choices I'd picked earlier. When the waitress retreated, Natalie looked up at me.
"When I was young, my best friend died. I know it's not even close to the same, but I remember how awful it was."
"What happened?"
"We were both 12. She lived two doors down, and her birthday was only a week before mine. Her parents were friends with my parents, so we pretty much grew up together. Went to the same school. We were in the same class all the way through. We even both took the same dance lessons. At the time, I think I was closer to Georgiana than I was to either my sister or my brother. Even when we weren't together, we spoke on the phone all the time. But anyway, we'd walked home from school together. I remember we were talking about this boy named Jeff, who she thought was cute, and she was wondering whether he liked her, too. We said goodbye at my house, and I remember hugging her goodbye. We always hugged. Anyway, about an hour after that, she wanted an ice cream sandwich, so she decided to walk to the convenience store maybe 3 blocks away. While she was walking, she was hit by a drunk driver and died. I could tell by her expression that she was reliving that moment,
and I stayed silent. When she finally realized I hadn't responded, she shook her head. Like I said, it's not the same as losing both your parents. I didn't lose my best friend when I was young, either. I'm sorry for your loss. Thank you, she said. Then, exhibiting a bit of false cheer, she added, But look at us. Could our conversation get any more depressing? I prefer to think of it as the two of us being honest with each other. It's still not the best dinner topic. What would you like to discuss instead? Anything. All right, I said. What else can you tell me about growing up? Good things, I mean. Like what? Did you have any pets? When she looked skeptical, I added, I'm just trying to get an idea of who you are. We had a dog and a cat for most of my childhood. They were named Fred and Barney.
From the Flintstones?
Exactly. How about family vacations? We took them all the time, she said. We went to Disney World every other year. We'd go skiing in West Virginia or Colorado. And we'd rent a house in the Outer Banks for 2 weeks every summer. One set of grandparents lived in Charlotte and another near Boone, so we'd visit them too. There were a lot of long car rides, and I used to dread them. But now I think it helped us form closer ties as a family. It sounds idyllic. It was, she said, seemingly growing more comfortable with sharing. I have no complaints about our family life.
I don't know too many people who can say that. I thought everyone had issues with their parents.
I'm not saying they were perfect, but it was easier for me and my siblings because they get along so well. Considering they work together all day and then go home together, you'd think they'd get tired of each other. But my dad is still crazy about my mom, and she dotes on him. There was a lot of laughter, and we had dinner together every night as a family. I grinned, marveling at how different our childhoods had been.
What led you to choose NC State after you finished high school?
It's where my dad went to school, she answered. My mom went to Meredith, which is an all-girls college in Raleigh. But after Salem Academy, I wanted a big public co-ed school. I also knew it would make my dad happy. In fact, all of us, my brother and sister, went to NC State. We're all die-hard Wolfpack fans, in case you're wondering. Even my mom has been converted. My dad has season tickets for football, and we usually have a family tailgate once or twice a year. My parents go to every home game.
And that's where you met the guy you followed to New Bern, right?
Mark, she said, adding nothing else.
You loved him? I asked.
Yes, she said, her gaze falling. But he's not someone I want to talk about.
Fair enough, I said.
I think I have a pretty good idea of who you are, even without that part of your life.
You do, huh?
Well, some of it anyway.
What's confusing you?
I'm still not sure why you decided to become a deputy. You strike me as more like the teacher or nurse type, or maybe an accountant.
Should I be offended by that?
I'm not saying you're not tough enough. I guess it's just that you strike me as intelligent, caring, and thoughtful. It's a good thing.
She scrutinized me for a beat.
I already told you, she answered. I sort of fell into it. But to your point about nursing, I get that a lot, actually, although I'm not sure why. To me, hospitals are... She hesitated. They're depressing. I hate hospitals. And besides, I get squeamish at the sight of blood.
Another reason not to be in your line of work.
I think we've established that I'm not engaging in shootouts every shift.
But if you were, you'd be fine, since you're an excellent shot.
My nickname is Bullseye, she said with a wink.
In my own mind, anyway. The waitress came by with bread and rolls, apologizing that she hadn't brought them earlier. I took a roll and buttered it, as did Natalie.
While we nibbled, the conversation continued to drift here and there with an ease typical of people who'd known each other far longer. We talked about the bees and beehives, shared memories of our college experiences, life in a small town versus the city, the Navy, favorite rides at Disney World, a bit about my parents and my grandfather. I even touched on my grandfather's curious journey to Easley and his final words to me. When the waitress brought our food, it was as delicious as Natalie had promised. Out of town or not, it was a place where I'd gladly eat again, especially with Natalie. Though our easy rapport continued throughout dinner, it never crossed into the territory of flirting. Whether she felt any real romantic interest in me was hard to tell. That she was enjoying dinner and my company, I had no doubt. As to whether she ever wanted to have dinner again, I honestly had no idea. And yet, I couldn't recall the last time I'd had such a pleasurable evening. It wasn't just because she'd said the right things when I'd told her about my parents, or that she'd shared with me her own loss from childhood. Instead, I realized that I admired the value she placed on certain things: family, education, friendship, and kindness, among other things. And it was clear that she struggled with some of the things she saw regularly on her job: addiction, domestic violence, bar fights. She confessed that those things sometimes left her feeling agitated and unable to sleep after a shift had ended. "Why don't you quit?" I finally asked. "You have a degree and work experience. I'm sure you could find something else." "Maybe," she admitted. "But for now, I think it's best if I stick with it."
"Because you want to make a difference?"
She touched the thin gold chain at her neck. "Sure," she finally said. "Let's go with that." Neither one of us was in the mood for dessert, but we agreed on coffee. A little caffeine would help with the drive back to New Bern. As she stirred her cup, I realized that aside from work and family, she'd told me little about herself since she'd arrived in New Bern a few years back. In fact, she'd said barely anything about her life in New Bern at all. Maybe to her it wasn't all that interesting. But as I turned these facts over in my mind, Natalie stared out the window. Because of the interior lights of the restaurant, I was treated to her profile as it was reflected back in the glass. And in that moment, I understood that instead of focusing on the evening we'd just spent together, she had something else on her mind. Something that made her feel sad. In old school fashion, and because I'd invited her, I paid the check. To her credit, she was content to let me do so with a gracious thank you. The night had cooled by the time we began the ambling trek toward our vehicles. It was clear, with a spray of stars overhead, and the Milky Way illuminating a path toward the horizon. The streets were empty, but from the restaurants near the water, I could hear the faint murmur of conversation and clinking glasses. Waves gently lapped against the seawall. It still wasn't late, and I thought about suggesting that we'd sit on the veranda of the restaurant with its glorious view, but I was nearly certain that she'd decline. To that point, we'd yet to have had so much as a glass of wine when we were together. Not that it mattered. It was simply another interesting quality of the time we'd spent together. "I was thinking about what you told me earlier," she finally said, "about your grandfather."
"Which part?"
"His last trip and his end at the hospital," she said. "You're sure that he'd never mentioned Easley before?"
"Not to me," I said. "Claude didn't know anything either, but I haven't spoken with his father yet."
"Then for all you know, he could have been on the way to somewhere else," she pointed out.
By then, we'd reached the waterfront. She paused, her ocean-colored eyes searching mine. A strand of spun gold hair fell across her face, and I was tempted to tuck it behind her ear. Her voice broke my reverie.
"Have you thought about trying to find his truck?"
"His truck?"
"There might be something in the cab," she explained. "Maybe an itinerary, or the name of whomever he was visiting, or even the place he was going. Notes, maps, anything."
Even before she'd finished speaking, I wondered why I hadn't thought of it before. Then again, I wasn't in law enforcement or a fan of mystery novels, so maybe that had something to do with it.
"You're right," I mused aloud. "But how would I find his truck?"
"I'd start with the hospital. Find out who they use for ambulance services. There's probably a record somewhere of where they picked him up. Depending on where he was found, the truck might still be there. Or it may have been towed, but at least you'll have a starting point."
"That's a great idea," I said. "Thank you."
"You're welcome," she nodded. "And let me know what happens. I'm interested, too."
"I will," I said. "Which reminds me, I don't think I have your cell number, in case I need to call." Or wanted to call, which was far more likely.
Oh, she said, and I got the impression that she wasn't sure how she felt about that. Not wanting to give her too much time to think, I reached for my phone and activated the contact list. After a moment, she took it, her reluctance was clear, and typed in her details before handing it back to me. I should probably be heading back, she announced. Early day tomorrow, and I still have to finish some laundry. I understand, I said. I have a busy day tomorrow, too. Thank you again for dinner. You're welcome. It was a pleasure getting to know you better.
You too. It was nice.
Nice? Not exactly the description I'd been hoping for. Oh, before you go, let me get the honey. I retrieved the jars from my SUV and handed them over, feeling a kinetic jolt as our fingers brushed. I was reminded of the way she'd gently touched my scar earlier. I knew I wanted to kiss her, but she must have read my mind and automatically took a small step backward. In the sudden space between us, I detected a lingering energy, as though she'd wanted to kiss me as well. Perhaps I was imagining it, but I thought I detected a trace of regret in her parting smile. Thank you for these, too, she said. I'm almost out. She turned and slowly made her way to her car. As I watched her go, I thought of something and pulled the phone from my pocket again. The screen was still on the contact page, and I dialed the number. A few seconds later, I heard the faint sound of a phone beginning to ring. She reached into her purse before catching sight of the number and glancing at me over her shoulder.
Just checking, I said.
She rolled her eyes before getting into her car. I waved as she drove past, and she returned the gesture before reaching the road that would take her back to New Bern. Alone, I wandered to the railing, watching the ocean sparkle in the moonlight. The breeze had picked up, cooling the air, and I turned my face to it, pondering her reluctance to kiss me. Was it part of her overall hesitation to appear in public with me? Was she really worried about small-town gossip, even this far from New Bern? Or was it that she was already seeing someone else? Chapter 7. I hadn't been lying to Natalie when I'd said I had things to do on Monday, as opposed to most days when I had time to goof off before taking a break and then goofing off some more. The responsibilities of life sometimes intruded, even if I didn't have to punch a clock or show up at the hospital or office. For starters, it was almost the middle of April, and my taxes were officially due. The documents had been waiting for weeks in a cardboard box delivered courtesy of UPS. I used the same accounting firm my parents had used, initially because I knew nothing about finance or accounting. And after that, because I assumed that switching to another firm would add unnecessary complications to my life, when things were already complicated enough. Frankly, thinking about money bores me, probably because I've never had to really worry about it. My taxes were complicated because of the various trusts, investments, and portfolios I'd inherited from my parents, some of which had been funded with more life insurance than either of my parents needed. Still, whenever I saw my net worth, my accountants would meticulously prepare a balance sheet for me every February. I would sometimes wonder why I'd been so insistent on becoming a doctor in the first place. It wasn't as though I needed the money. The interest I collected annually was a lot more than I would ever earn as a doctor. But I think something inside me craved my parents' approval, even if they were no longer around. When I graduated from medical school, I imagined them clapping in the audience. In my mind's eye, I saw my mom's eyes welling with tears while my father beamed with pride at a job well done. In that moment, I understood clearly that I'd rather my parents were alive than to have received the generous inheritance they'd left me. When my statements arrive in the mail every year, I'm always reminded of those losses, and there are times when I'm too overwhelmed to even peruse them. Even though I'd tried to explain it to Natalie while we'd been at dinner, I knew I hadn't been able to find the words to adequately express the loss or grief I really felt. Because I was an only child, I hadn't just lost my parents. I'd lost my entire immediate family as well. Over the years, I'd gradually come to believe that family is like your shadow on a sunny day, always there, just over your shoulder, following you in spirit no matter where you are or what you're doing. They're always with you. Thank God my grandfather was there to carry on part of that role, as he had so many other roles when I was younger. With his passing, however, the days are now endlessly cloudy, and when I glance over my shoulder, there is nothing there at all. I know there are others in my situation, but that doesn't make me feel any better. It just makes me think that no shadows follow them either, that they, like me, often feel entirely alone. Reflecting on all of this made me wonder whether I would actually sell my grandfather's property. Though I'd told myself that I'd come to New Bern to get the place ready for the realtor, it was also the only remaining link to both my mother and my grandfather. At the same time, if I didn't sell, I wasn't sure what I'd do with it. I couldn't simply lock it up. The vagrant might break in again, right? But I wasn't sure I wanted to rent it either, because I didn't want strangers messing with the peculiar charm of the place. In the room where I'd slept as a kid, there were pencil marks on the closet door where my grandfather had duly etched my height next to those he'd marked for my mother. The thought that someone might paint over that history wasn't something I wanted to contemplate. My condo in Pensacola had simply been a place where I lived. This house, my grandfather's house, carried the ghosts of meaningful memory. It was a place where the past continued to whisper, as long as I was willing to hear it. Knowing I had a lot to do, I went for a halfway decent run, showered, and poured myself a cup of coffee. At the table, I went through the documents from my accountants. As always, there was a cover letter that explained everything I needed to know, and little stickers on various forms indicating where I needed to sign. My eyes began glazing over at the 30-second mark, which was normal, and I finished two additional cups of coffee before finally sliding the various documents into the appropriate pre-addressed envelopes. By mid-morning, I stood in line at the post office, making sure everything was postmarked, before heading back to the house and writing an email to my accountants, letting them know the deed was done. Next on the to-do list were the beehives. After donning the same suit I'd worn the day before, I loaded the wheelbarrow with the equipment I needed, then collected a few shallow supers, along with some queen excluders. I hoped that I wasn't too late. Without the queen excluder, the queen might suddenly fly off in search of a new hive, taking her swarm with her. That was what had happened in Brazil in 1957, after scientists spread Africanized honeybees, aka killer bees, thinking they would thrive in the tropical conditions. A visiting beekeeper, believing the queen excluders were hindering the movement of the bees inside the hives, removed them, and 26 queens, as well as their swarms, escaped, traveling north, eventually reaching the U.S. I pushed the wheelbarrow along the same path I'd used the day before, intending to work from left to right. As I got settled in place, I glanced toward the road and saw Callie walking, most likely on her way to the trading post. Like the other times I'd seen her walking, her head was bowed and she shuffled along with what seemed to be grim determination. Wandering toward the edge of the property, I held up a hand in greeting. "Off to work?" My sudden appearance must have startled her, and she stopped. "You again?" They were the same words Natalie had said to me at the park by the river, and I was struck by the notion that Callie was equally mysterious and guarded. "It's me," I said. Then realizing I was wearing the suit, I motioned toward the hives. "I have to do some work on the hives so the bees stay happy." She continued to eye me almost warily. When she crossed her arms, I noticed a bruise near her elbow. "They're bees. Can't they take care of themselves?" "You're right," I admitted. "They're not like termite in that you have to feed them, but they still need a little tending now and then." "Do they like you?"
"Who, the bees?"
"Yes, the bees."
"I don't know. They seem okay with me."
"You're wearing a suit. I never saw your grandpa wear a suit. When I walked past here, I mean."
He was braver than I am.
For the first time since I'd seen her, she cracked the slightest of smiles.
"What did you want?"
"Nothing. I saw you walking past and thought I'd say hello."
"Why?"
"Why?" I hadn't expected the question, and for a moment I couldn't think of a response.
"Just being neighborly, I suppose."
She seemed to stare right through me. We're not neighbors, she said. I live a ways down the road. You're right, I said. I have to go, she said. I don't want to be late for work.
Fair enough. I don't want you to be late either.
Then why did you stop me to talk to you?
I thought I'd answered that with the whole being neighborly thing, but I guess to her mind, I hadn't. But feeling as though she wanted to end the conversation sooner rather than later, again like Natalie at the farmer's market, which made me think how similar they were in temperament, I took a step backward toward the wheelbarrow.
No reason, I said. Have a great day.
She waited until I'd retreated a few steps before starting to walk again. And though I didn't turn around to check, I was certain she didn't cast so much as a single glance my way. Not that it was any of my business. I put on the hood and gloves, then moved the wheelbarrow closer to the first of the hives. I got the smoker going, puffed enough to calm the hive, and waited another minute before removing both lids. I added the excluder to the top of the upper deep, put the shallow upper super on top of that, and put the lids back on. Same things with the second, third, and fourth hives. I refilled the wheelbarrow multiple times, lost in the routine and remembering my grandfather, until all the hives were done. Fortunately, all the queens were still in place.